behalf of Pfizer Animal Health, certainly like to welcome you all to this session of Cattlemen's College. And Pfizer is really very proud to be able to sponsor these each year. And I hope that you'll be able to take home a lot from this session that you can use in your operations and improve the beef industry. So look forward to the session.
Thank you. Today we'll be hearing from two speakers. The first speaker is Dr. John Patterson, who's a professor of animal science and a beef extension specialist at Montana State University. We'll also be hearing from Dr. Terry Engel from Colorado State University, and I'll go ahead and turn the mic over to Dr. Patterson now.
Thank you and good morning. I am John Patterson, Extension Specialist from Montana State, and if you want to have a great job, you work in Montana along the Canadian border. We were given an assignment about 3 or 4 months ago by Renee Lloyd. Renee said, John, we want you to talk about trace minerals, but we don't want you to say anything about formulation, different products, and that. What we want you to do is to tell us the science that was involved in how you guys came to making these certain recommendations out there. So it's a science-based talk today. And to do that, we decided to split this program up. And my colleague, Dr. Terry Engel from Colorado State, is going to take the basic side of this. He's going to tell you the metabolic pathways that are involved in trace minerals and how we came about understanding that we need these trace minerals. After Terry's done, then I'm going to take it over and I'm going to talk about the cowboy side of it. Could we apply this out in the field? What did the science say once we took the results from people like Terry and then began to apply them into cow herds or feed yards or backgrounding operations? And the reason that we got Terry is because we believe Terry's going to be one of the best trace mineral men in the country in the next 25 years. He's a new guy, Colorado State, comes out of North Carolina. But Terry has got a very, very active program and understands the basic side of trace minerals better than anybody I know in the country. And that's why we have Terry here. So, Terry, I'm going to turn it over to you to have you start on the fundamental side of trace mineral nutrition.
Thanks, Doc. Can everybody hear me okay back there? Is this mic working okay? A little louder? How's that? Any better? Okay. Thanks for the introduction there, Dr. Patterson. I do appreciate the invitation to speak with you folks today. As Dr. Patterson said, one of our assignments was to talk about some of the basics relative to trace mineral metabolism and then get into how to apply it in the field. This does not, by any stretch of the imagination, mean that the macro minerals or calcium, phosphorus are not important. It was just truly a time limitation on what we could cover. And so Dr. Patterson and I got together and said, well, what are most of the questions we get? And that came about with trace minerals. So what I want to do today is actually just talk about certain factors that affect trace mineral metabolism in beef cattle. Now, I do want to warn you, there is an exam after this presentation, and I didn't make it up. It's Dr. Patterson's fault. And so there will be something going on afterwards, and I guess the person that gets the best grade gets a hug from Dr. Patterson. I'm not exactly sure, but he's offered that one up. And so what I want to do is just run through some slides here and talk a little bit about some of the basic trace mineral factors that affect trace mineral requirements in beef cattle. And as a general outline, I want to talk about general functions of trace minerals and just give you a brief idea of what's going on there, essential elements. Then I want to talk about biological, pharmacological, and toxicological responses. And Dr. Patterson will get into a little bit on the toxicity side of certain trace elements of beef cattle, and then troubleshooting some deficiency problems, which we'll get into later on in the presentation. So with general functions of trace minerals, obviously a big part of where the trace minerals fit in is maintenance of homeostasis, osmotic pressure, acid-base balance, very important. The chloride ion is a very important mineral that's involved in acid-base balance relative to the red blood cell. Signal transduction, how cells communicate with, how hormones communicate with cells. Where you'll find a lot of the functions of trace minerals is the catalytic or enzymatic activity. And we can classify those enzymes that require or utilized elements for metals is metalloenzymes or metal-activated enzymes. And a metalloenzyme is an enzyme that requires a metal to function appropriately. The metal is an integral part of that enzyme. If it's not there, the enzyme won't function. These metal-activated enzymes are enzymes that can function on their own, but if metals are present, they function a little bit more efficiently. Components for regulators of hormones, iodine is a big one, heavily involved in energy metabolism. Also, a component of B12, this is the cyanocobalamin, or cobalt. And cobalt is very important for the production of this B12, and B12 allows the propionate conversion, succinate, or CoA that can go back up to glucose or be oxidized and generate ATP at the end of the day. An area we're getting fairly heavily involved with on the B-cell side is gene expression. We're not going to talk too much about that today, but this is an expanding area. Membrane stability, trace minerals do assist in membrane stability, and then immunity. And I just want to mention, one of the reasons I keep my hair so short is so I don't pull it out, okay? Because this is very frustrating when you talk about immunity, because sometimes you see responses, sometimes you don't. And that, I want to talk a little bit more about that. I'll have some slides relative to certain factors that can affect not only trace mineral metabolism, but the immune response as well. So, to define an essential element, I'll just read this. It's one that's required to support adequate growth, reproduction, and health throughout the life cycle when all other elements are optimal, all the nutrients are optimal. And that's a key word right there, optimal. It's very difficult to get an optimal diet, because I'm not sure we know exactly what an optimal diet is. Okay, but these essential elements are one in which a limitation will consistently result in impairment of a specific function from optimal to suboptimal. Okay, they need to be present in healthy animals, some type of regulation of placental transfer, some homeostatic regulation as well. And so I want to just briefly go through this, because in order for an element, and we're talking about trace minerals here, to be essential, it needs to have some type of biological response. Okay, the biological response, and the way this acts is set up, this is activity, it could be enzyme activity, it could be growth, average daily gain, pregnancy rate, and then the concentration, these are just generic numbers here. And an essential element needs to have some type of biological response where, as you increase the supplementation, you get an improvement in whatever you're measuring over here, and so you see no more improvement. And in general, that would be where the requirement would be for that animal. Now, I think everyone has a pretty good idea about toxicological responses. Obviously, there's going to be some negative impact out here when you get to a certain concentration. One thing from the poultry and swine data that's been fairly evident is trace minerals can also have a pharmacological response. Okay, and this is pretty interesting, but where, and I'll just give you an example from the poultry and swine data, they can feed these animals, and I'm talking about copper, for example, they can feed these animals about 25 times their copper requirement and see a growth response, okay, and see an improvement in health. Now, if you did that to a cow, you'd have a dead cow on your hands, okay? They're very susceptible to copper toxicity, but this pharmacological response has been seen in other species relative to this improvement in performance and health. But the digestive system and the metabolism of certain elements is much different in ruminants than it is in non-ruminants. Okay, so getting into the presentation here, what factors affect trace mineral metabolism B-cal? Now, I want to just kind of give you a general outline of these factors I'm going to talk about. But the two that I want to talk about are a chemical relative to a mineral-mineral interaction. And a lot of you heard the sulfur-molybdenum copper interaction, which I'll talk about, but some others as well. I want to focus on the gastrointestinal tract, both at the rumen level and the small intestine. And we're going to talk about what takes place inside the lumen of the small intestine, or where the digestive sit, and at the cellular level. But not all inhibitors are bad. There are certain systems set up in your intestinal cells that help to prevent the absorption of certain elements, like cadmium is very toxic to animals. And so this inhibition process is set up to help to prevent or slow down cadmium if an animal ingests a bunch of cadmium. But that can have ramifications on some other things as well, like copper and zinc metabolism and absorption. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that, metabolic and physiological parameters from the biochemical standpoint, animal factors that affect tracing requirements, obviously species, and even breeds. Different breeds of animals, of cattle, will metabolize minerals differently. And that's a struggle right there. Immune response. Different breeds of cattle respond differently to the same antigen. Okay, and this is where I really struggle with trying to figure out or look at all the data, because there is some variation relative to the data that's out there. Gestational status, I'm going to talk about that, and then environmental factors relative to stress. Okay, interactions with other elements. Now, this is what I think of, and this is a crazy thing. I'll give you a minute to get this copy down. But when you ask me if there's a mineral, if you have a copper deficiency, this is what goes into my head. What factors are affecting that specific mineral that you think you have a deficiency in or a problem with? Well, this is nice to see, and I think Dr. Pools did a really good job putting it together, but it is complex. Well, kind of to straighten this whole thing out, give you a picture of the periodic table. I am a big fan. Those of you who know me know I love the periodic table. I think you should have one in your wallet, your purse, the bathroom, all that good stuff. Very important piece of information here. The reason I like it, and this is a general rule of thumb, it doesn't work all the time. Okay? But in general, if an element is in the same row or touching one another, there's a potential for an antagonism to occur. Okay? And so if you get a mineral analysis back and you see that you have high zinc and low copper, well, high zinc can induce a copper deficiency. Okay, so the signs you might be seeing are a copper deficiency sign, but it might be induced by a zinc overload. Okay, and that's just something that, in general, it works. Not all the time, though, because it's just a general rule of thumb. One thing that I have been seeing lately in the past year and a half is aluminum start to creep up in certain portions of the country, mostly in Colorado and the mountain range. This can have a huge impact on phosphorus metabolism, which then impacts calcium metabolism. You see some bone disorders. So this is one that's not commonly looked at, very expensive to have analyzed. But if you think you're having some bone disorders, that might be one area just to take a peek at. Okay, the interactions I just want to address today very briefly, the copper molybdenum sulfur interaction. This is probably the most famous interaction. I think everyone has a pretty good handle on it. But I do want to just caution you that high concentrations of molybdenum, and this is from experimental data, at 10 parts per million may not affect copper status any more than 5 parts per million. Okay, so it doesn't necessarily need to be very high to have an impact. But it really does matter what the sulfur concentration is and the copper concentration is in the ration. Okay, iron, I want to talk a little bit about iron, how it induces the copper deficiency, or potentially could. The interesting thing about copper and iron is they work together in the body. Okay, they're very closely tied. A copper-dependent enzyme is involved in depositing iron, converting iron from different valence states, and allowing iron to go into red blood cells. Okay, so they work together in the body, but they're heavily antagonistic in the gut. High iron concentrations have a huge impact on copper absorption, will reduce it. We'll talk a little bit about that. And this one, I'm glad I had this in here because I was asked this on the plane, is how does high zinc decrease copper absorption? So these are some of the big ones that I want to discuss today, and then Dr. Patterson will take over here in a bit. Okay, inhibition of copper metabolism by molybdenum and sulfur. And this is a sheep study where they're looking at the interactions of molybdenum sulfur and this molybdenum sulfur complex on copper absorption. And the basal diet contained 0.1% sulfur and 0.5 parts per million molybdenum, so pretty low. And then they added, and so they looked at the percent reduction in copper absorption. And what they saw when they added 4 parts per million molybdenum, saw about a 0.5% reduction in copper absorption, not too drastic there. When they added sulfur, you see a fairly substantial reduction in copper absorption relative to this diet here. Then you add 4 parts per million molybdenum and 0.3% sulfur, you get about a 62% reduction in copper. So there's some interactions taking place that are very important, and those interactions are defined down here. the first one up here, when they just added molybdenum, that there may be an impact or an interaction relative to copper and molybdenum, but it reduces about 0.5%. Not a huge reduction. The formation of cupric molybdate is most likely occurring here, copper binding to the molybdenum. But I have yet to see any data that shows that in an animal system. All this, you can generate this in a test tube real easy, but I have yet to see it in a cow. Okay, so I don't know on that, so the question mark there. Copper and sulfur alone, sulfur can form this copper sulfide formation. That's why you get that 31% reduction in the absorption of copper. But then this big interaction of copper, sulfur, and molybdenum, you get the thiomolybdate formation, and there are more than one type of thiomolybdate. And this is where it gets a little crazy, because there's actually four. And I'll give you a picture of what kind of that looks like. When you have the combination of molybdenum and sulfur in a highly reducing environment, which is the rumen, what's going to happen is you're going to get you can accumulate sulfur compounds on this molybdenum. And basically, a monothiomolybdate has one sulfur, di has two, tri has three, and tetra has four. So it's basically the accumulation of the addition of sulfur. And each of these, the mono, di, tri, and tetra, can have an impact. It has a high affinity for copper, binding copper. Okay? And the interesting thing about this is you can reduce copper absorption with the tri and tetrathiomolybdates. Okay? What's going to happen is interactions will take place in the rumen. Copper is going to bind to this tri or dithiomolybdate, and it's going to pass right out of the animal, not be absorbed. The harder thing to figure out is, to some extent, these mono and dithiomolybdates can get absorbed into the bloodstream. And then they can have an impact, and to some extent the trithiomolybdates can, but mostly the mono and di can have an impact on how copper is distributed in the body. It can scavenge copper. So these can get into the bloodstream and cause some problems. They may inhibit certain copper-dependent enzymes. And please don't copy this down, because this is a theoretical picture of how, at least we think from the rat models and some of the human studies, that copper is being absorbed. But I can assure you we're working on this on the bovine side, and it's crazier than it even looks here, because I'm sure there's actually more, based on bovine genome mapping, there seems to be more than one receptor associated with copper absorption, and there seems to be several different gene segments that have an impact on how this protein is produced. So, and that brings copper in. There's regulation at the Trans-Golgi network with the MK protein, and then copper somehow gets through a transport mechanism and bound to albumin. The key point to this is that when copper is bound to albumin, it's bound to histidine moiety. Okay, histidine amino acid, or pick up copper. This typically takes to the liver, deposit copper in the liver. Copper then will be transported to ceruloplasmin and goes around the body. Okay, and then whatever tissues need it, that's how it's transported. Well, when you have these thiomolybdates coming in from the gut, or from the rumen, out here in the gut, and this is the intestinal cell in the blood, these mono, di, and tri, to some extent, can get absorbed across the intestinal cell. Okay, when that happens, they can bind copper along the way, or they can bind copper once they get into the plasma, and then they'll hook up with that histidine amino acid. But the problem is the binding coefficient is much stronger here. The thiomolybdate is associated with that amino acid, then the copper. So this right here, the tight binding coefficient, and will not be released typically from this albumin. So once this shows up as this form, this albumin can't get rid of it to dump it into the liver, and the liver can convert it to dump it into ceruloplasmin and take it to the rest of the body. One of the big problems here is, though, if you take a blood sample, you can detect copper, but it doesn't tell you which form it is in. There are some chemistry techniques you can use to look at the binding coefficient here, but to date I haven't found a very good one that works fairly repeatable. So you can still detect copper in the blood, but if it's bound like this, it's typically not available to the animal. So looking at some production data, some reproduction in heifers relative to this molybdenum issue we've been talking about, And the way this study was set up, they have control animals, molybdenum supplement at 5 parts per million, and then restriction control. And what this restriction control is if there's a reduction in intake from this treatment right here, these animals will parafed to that to try to eliminate some energy impacts here. What you see is controls 59.1 relative to liver copper concentration, huge reduction in liver copper concentrations with the molybdenum added. And I do want to add that there was quite a bit of sulfur in this ration too, so we're probably getting those thiamolybdate forms. And then the restriction controls, when you limit the restricted controls to the energy intake of this group, they actually had a higher liver copper concentration than even the controls, which indicates that there's probably some upregulation during when you restrict animals on feed. They can regulate absorption of certain elements. Obviously, age of puberty. I'm not a reproductive physiologist. If you ask me a question, I'll prove that to you. But what they tell me is, age of puberty, if the number's bigger, that's bad. So that molybdenum effect was there. Weight at puberty, obviously lower here, but there might be an energy impact here. But the big thing relative to the peak LH concentrations of reproductive hormone here is they were drastically reduced. So they're probably impairing some type of reproductive performance in these animals. The problem is, and I think this is an excellent study, but one of the issues here is obviously the molybdenum induced the copper deficiency. Okay, but was this impact here and down here due to a copper deficiency per se, or was it due to these copper deficiency? And I'll show you some data here in a minute that it might be those thiamolybdates that do something completely different relative of copper. This is growing steers here, fed corn-silage-based diet. Look at 10 parts per million copper supplemented, and then 5 or 10 parts per million molybdenum. In general, we don't see too much on the performance side, but the liver copper concentrations obviously were drastically reduced here. And the reason I want to show you this is that 5 didn't reduce it any further than 10. In fact, it was, those numbers are not different from one another. But so you don't see a reduction in copper any further from 5 versus 10. But you do see a reduction in the plasma copper concentrations. When plasma copper concentrations do fall that low, that animal is severely deficient. Now, one of the things I want to talk about relative to copper metabolism again is iron. And this is something that I'm kind of going to link back to this whole concept of a thiamolybdate causing a potential problem with reproductive efficiency in animals. Simple study, a very similar study to the one before, controlled, and they added 500 parts per million iron, and they have a restricted control. And what's taking place here is this iron is having an impact on liver copper concentration. That's to reduce liver copper concentration. We don't see too much of an impact at age puberty, weighted puberty, but peak LH concentrations were a little bit lower, but that might be an energy impact. So if we induce a copper deficiency with iron, you don't see that big of an impact on reproductive efficiency of animals, which leads me to believe that, in fact, those thiamolybdates themselves may be doing something else relative to reproductive efficiency in animals. Same thing relative to, on the steer side, looking at 10 parts per million copper. What we do see is if they have a control, 10 parts per million copper, or 500 or 1,000 parts per million iron supplemented to the diet. We are seeing a reduction in gain. Feed intake is going to drop. And what you do see is the reduction in liver copper concentration. So iron is going to have an impact on performance. Excess iron is going to have an impact on performance in steers as well as copper status. This is a question I was actually asked on the airplane ride down here. So I'm glad I put this in here. But high zinc can decrease copper absorption. And I just want to show you kind of how that works out. From a schematic standpoint, relative to zinc, and this is the gut here, this is the intestinal cell, and this is the blood. We're not exactly for sure how zinc gets into the intestinal cell, but there is some regulation here. In a normal situation, zinc will be absorbed, bind to a binding protein, transported over to a transport protein bound to albumin. Again, very similar to that of copper. The interesting thing about zinc is if animal consumes a high amount of zinc relative to its requirements, that zinc can be absorbed. But what's going to happen is it's going to induce something to take place, to turn on a gene in the genome of the animal to cause the induction of a protein. So basically, this excess zinc, if this pool goes really high, it's going to be interacting with certain genes in the animal's intestinal cell to turn on a protein, to produce a protein called methylthionine. There's several different types of methylthionine, but this is involved in actual. And what will happen is this methylthionine binds to the zinc and doesn't let it go. Okay, so it can't get across into the blood, and this intestinal cell is sloughed off several days later, and that's how the animal rids itself from zinc, from excess zinc. But the problem here is, relative to the zinc, zinc can induce this protein, but this protein has a much higher binding coefficient for copper. So once you induce this protein to be produced, it'll bind up all the copper, and that's how a high zinc concentration in the ration can induce a copper deficiency. Okay, the mechanism is set up here to prevent the zinc deficiency, but that methylthionine protein has a much higher binding coefficient for copper. Okay, other factors that affect or inhibit or alter some kind of trace mineral metabolism in beef cattle. Animal species and breed, and I'm going to talk just show you a graph here relative to these three critters, and then breed of cattle. Simple study here looking at liver copper concentrations at different doses, and green line would be the swine. At high doses, you don't see accumulation in liver until like 80 parts per million, and then that's going to be pretty high out here at 160. Cattle, kind of intermediate, 20 is when I get a little concerned, but when liver copper concentrations get up in the 400 to 600 range, that's pretty high. And so there's a difference between, obviously, cattle and pigs. And the sheep, everyone, I think, has a pretty good idea why this line doesn't extend any further. They all croak about this point. Okay. So in general, obviously, that's a whole other story, though, why sheep are more susceptible to copper than cattle. But species, it's different. They're different, which is not surprising. But breed of cattle can have an impact on mineral metabolism. And this is some studies we did several years ago. And I just basically looked at liver copper concentrations of Simmental and Angus. I'm not picking on breeds. I'm just saying they're different. Growing, finishing steers receiving no supplemental copper. So I didn't feed them any copper in the basal feedlot ration. Okay, only copper they were getting was whatever was from corn silage, corn, or the other ingredients. But I didn't add any. And I took liver biopsies at 0, 56, 140, and 168 days on feed. And you can see they started out the same. And here's the Angus. They plateaued down to about 70 parts per million after 168 days. Simmental, much more of a drastic reduction in liver copper concentration. So they're metabolizing it differently. Okay, and why is that? Well, there is some evidence that for some reason Simmental cattle will excrete. They'll absorb the copper. They'll be transported to the liver, and then they'll excrete more back out in the bile. So then it goes in the small intestine and out the rear end of the animal. So not exactly sure why that occurs. But there is a breed difference here. Same on the dairy side. Holsteins versus Jerseys. Jerseys are more susceptible to copper toxicity than Holsteins. And you can see this is only 5 parts per million supplemental copper for 60 days. Pretty drastic increase in the Jerseys. Slower slope or different slope, a rate of increase in relative to the copper accumulation in the liver. So, breed differences in mineral metabolism. But also, there's breed differences in immune response. And this, to figure out these interactions between breed differences in mineral metabolism and breed differences in immune response. And I'm not sure if there's a connection, but there possibly could be. Another study we did, we just took Angus and Simmental purebred animals and inoculated them with IBR, got them real sick. And this measured rectal temperature responses. And nice response in rectal temperature. But what we see is the Angus calves ran a higher rectal temperature than the Simmental calves to the same antigen. Same thing too. I had to find something these animals have never been exposed to. So when I was in North Carolina, there's a lot of pigs in North Carolina, so go bleed them and you can purify the red blood cells and inject them into these animals, and it's a perfect primary immune response for these animals. And you can see this is just titer responses, and they're different. Angus cattle had a higher titer response than Simmental cattle. I'm not saying that's good or bad. I'm saying it's different. So something to watch out for. Is this connected to differences in mineral metabolism? I don't know. Same with the dairy breeds. brown Swiss versus the Asian. Same type of response here. Same antigen, different antibody type of response. So the immune system of these animals is different when responding to the same antigen. Chemical form of feed, I think, is another factor that will have an impact on trace mineral metabolism in beef cattle. If a feed analyzes 30 parts per million, it does not necessarily mean that all that zinc is available to the animal. Fiber, you're never going to get away from that from the cattle side. Tannins, oxalates. How many of your folks told you not to eat raw rhubarb before? Well, maybe they did. Oxalates are very, very high in raw rhubarb and very high in the leaves. This will cause some serious kidney stone, tie up some ionized calcium. If you eat too much of it, it'll have more ionized calcium and stop your diaphragm from contracting, which makes those calcium stones in your ear or in the bladder not seem so bad. But if you don't remember anything from this talk, remember to lay off the raw rhubarb. It's bad for you. Okay? Phytate, typically not a problem on the ruminant side, although there is some evidence or some current research going on with phytate. One other thing that, and I'm not a plant physiologist or a soil chemist, but typically, from soil type and fertilization, typically if you increase the soil pH to increase the yield on forage, here's just an example of what happens to the cobalt. It goes down, manganese in the forage will drop, and molybdenum concentrations go up. So soil pH has an impact on what type of nutrients are in that plant. Okay, and this is not what you want to see typically in forages that you're going to feed your cattle. Obviously, other factors, age, rate of growth, lactation versus non-lactating, and pregnancy. One thing on pregnancy is if you're going to do liver biopsies for analysis of trace mineral status, you've got to be careful, especially with copper, because if you take that biopsy close, those liver copper concentrations should be lower. Okay, those animals typically kind of transfer a lot of copper to that calf, to that fetus, because there's not a lot of copper being transported in the milk. So the timing of this liver biopsy relative to pregnancy status can have an impact on your results. Another thing I want to talk about is this is just a table from the NRC. And what do you notice? This is mineral requirements and the maximum tolerable concentrations for certain trace elements. Here's the mineral. Growing finishing cattle, gestating, early lactation, the maximum tolerable concentration. What do you notice about the requirements for growing finishing cattle, gestating cattle, and early lactation? For all these minerals I listed, they're the same, right? But the one that would be different in the beef NRC is manganese, and that's a little different story, but does that make sense? You know, I scratch my head at this too, but can growing and finishing cattle have the same cobalt requirement, for example, than gestating animals versus early lactating animals? And I could tell you, and so I want to figure this out, and so I can tell you that the dietary requirement is most likely okay being the same here. The metabolic requirement is much different. And if you look at a pregnant animal, and this is some older data, but it's excellent data, looking at the gestational effects of total zinc and con-